very freedom that's cropped up when we deal with this American musical form we call jazz. In relationship to the music and in relationship to, if I may, its political meanings. To say, what does music have to do with politics? Well, we found that, it's always an education when you do get an opportunity to travel. And those of us who are in this business, we do have an opportunity to do that. And so we learn a lot about ourselves through this. I know recently, while going to Europe, we often wondered why, when we got to certain countries, a large portion of our concert activity would be sponsored by groups and cities that were administered by political parties or political folks who were far to the left of center most of the time. And they were young people, and we often said, well, how do they equate this music that was produced in this country to this attitude of freedom? Because oftentimes we're asked, how do you like our Italian jazz, or how do you like our Japanese jazz, or what do you think of our French jazz? And you have to give some kind of an answer, like, well, it sounds a little bit like this or that or this or something. Anyway, but we learned something, at least I did, that meant something to me, was that they equated this music with the democratic way of thinking. Because you see four or five people on stage, especially the small groups, and then a theme is introduced, and then all the rest of the players have an opportunity to express themselves within the confines of the harmonic and melodic and rhythmic structure, as well as the general ambience of the piece, whether it be maybe something that's supposed to be romantic or something that's supposed to be hard and fast. But everybody had the freedom to invent within the harmonic and, as I said, the melodic structure, rhythmic structure of the piece, and make that into a complete work that turned out, according to the competence of the musicians, to be sometimes a work of art. And it was done through a democratic process. Now, so the people who were seeking change equated this music, came from here, with that kind of freedom. So, because I recall once a very fine Italian composer said to me, he said, first of all, he said how fortunate we were to be able to play music, but we had this kind of freedom that made sense harmonically and melodically and get paid for it, because he which I thought was nice. You couldn't survive in my country without money. But anyway, he said to me, you know, when jazz came to us, those of us who wrote and worked in the symphony orchestras, as people who worked in the orchestra, because they're the classical orchestra at that time, the most important people were the conductor and the composer. And in political terms, it was almost like an imperialistic form, although the artists, as artists, you don't look at it like it. It's the work of people who have the genius to put all that together and call that. But in political terms, he said, because we would be sitting down in the orchestra almost like peons, and we did whatever someone else told us to do, where when you folks came with this kind of, this form of music, it introduced a democratic process as to how to create musical form. I felt very good about that. But anyway, they take it into a political area. And so most times when we are invited, especially in recent years, to tour in Europe, which we do quite often now, musicians like myself, it's usually for political parties, whether they're to the right or to the left, to attract kind of young thinkers who think politically differently than we do. They're much more involved with the process of how they are involved with their government. We seem to get involved politically just around election time. Other than that, It's party, dance, and disco, so to speak. Not you folks. I know nobody out here. Anyway, back to freedom. I'm going to play a piece that institutes this kind of free form, that utilizes rather this free form attitude, in my way, and the title of it is Scott Free.
Thank you.
maybe we can turn the lights up in the house. And this portion of the program, we can just open the open the stage up for your participation here. Some questions that you might have about this particular instrument or this music that we're dealing with, or whatever else I may have some knowledge about. If I don't know anything about it, I'll seek some advice from a higher source. I saw a ladder upstairs. I don't think there'll be any problem. But perhaps there are some questions that you'd like to ask me about myself or music.
Max, how long have you played with that set?
This one, I've had it about a year and a half or so.
Yeah. Well, I'm in the setup more than the set.
This particular setup?
Your arrangement.
Oh, it's been with me now. Basically, accepting the hanging tom-tom on the right or the left, as far as the audience is concerned, I guess about 15 years. But actually, this particular setup, I guess I've been using it since they had a double hanging tom-toms, you know, mostly, you know, when I was with, right after I left Gretsch, I went with the Miazzi drum company.
As far as recording drums, do you get fairly involved in the production of your records? And another two-part question, are you ever totally happy with the recorded sounds of your percussion?
Well, that's the answer to the last question first. At any session, any performance, I really do what the best I possibly can physically and mentally according to what I am. So it always, I always feel that if I give my best, that's it. Naturally, you'll listen to something after. And afterthoughts, you might say, wow, I could have done that, or why did I do that, or something like that.
Speaking of terms of technically capturing the sound of the percussion on the tape.
Now, that is something that's very personal. What I do, I like an open sound on the instrument. I'm not too, because I like that particular sound, and I like to control the sound. Some people like a muffled sound. Today, the popular sound is, of course, the damper. The damper in the instrument, and then play as hard as you possibly can. My way of dealing with it is just to keep them wide open and play with a certain feel and touch and try to get an open sound out of the instrument. I like to hear a little boom, or a little overtone, if you will, if I'm playing solo drums, you know, which is what I usually do now, of course. But, you know, it's according, you know, I use maybe a mic on the bass drum, one there between the snare and the foot cymbal, two hanging mics to capture the cymbal, and a mic that goes right in here that will capture this area of the instrument. So it's one, two, three, four, five, usually five mics. Count the bass drum, one, two, three, four, five mics. On a recording session. I know I just recently did a solo album that was released in Japan. And trying to think how many, I think. Oh yeah, what we did, and we recorded that album here in Massachusetts, incidentally, producing ourselves at the farm down here.
Longview
Farms, yeah. What we did there, the engineer, incidentally, was a drummer. What we did, we mic'd every drum, plus the bass drum and each cymbal. So we had one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. We had about nine mics because he wanted everything. And it took us almost half the day just to see if we got the right sound with everything. And then, of course, the mix. It makes it a bit more difficult to do the mix. I think it can be done by the sample.
The only good drum recording I've heard.
Yeah, it can be done by sampling. If the engineer can get you the two, that's perfect. setting and what you set it formally?
I was setting it on the...
It's one of the best it is.
Yeah. But I, you know, I'm so into the drum set that I can't seem to
get to the other things.
I don't want to. Not that I don't want to, it's just that
I can just tell you this, you know, and this applies for any instrumentalist. You know, it's fine to be a great instrumentalist, but it's better to be a musician. And being a musician means that you deal with all the possibilities of music. Now, you can be a fine drummer, but I would, if you don't want to deal, because it is, I know, because I deal with the total percussion. It's hard work because you got to spend as much time dealing with those mallets as you do with this. But what I did, I just went straight into composition. So that way I can deal with the total musical picture. Now, of course, you then have to acquire a taste for studying a theory and those things, which at first is fairly dry, you know, but at least it gives you more time to deal with your instrument. But it goes along with the thing about being, it's better, no matter how great an instrumentalist you are, if you are a good musician, you're going to even be a greater instrumentalist besides that. But also you can deal with the total musical picture, orchestrally speaking, as well as a composer. And this is the way you make a living in this business. It's not so much the instrumentalists, it's the writers. See, if you write a piece and I record it, Joni James records it, you know, you can sit down and just make it, just, you know, this is how you support yourself. So composing and that kind of thing is very important. So
how do you deal with, like, that instrument's not a melodic instrument? How do you deal with, like, jazz musicians and how they look upon an instrument? As far as, sometimes you get like, I don't know, almost get like, you know, the whole ego, like, I can't see this.
You mean there's always five musicians
and
a drummer?
Yeah, right.
I know, yeah, that's a... Well, see, you know how you can solve that problem?
No.
I remember when, we all know Oliver Nelson, God bless the dead, he's one of the great writers of our time. We had a heart attack a couple years ago in California. Well, I first met Oliver Nelson when he was going to the conservatory in St. Louis, and we were coming through there playing a gig in St. Louis. Clifford Brown, of course, we were all together during that period. And Oliver brought a piece in for us to rehearse. Came by that night, introduced himself, and said, you know, I write music and this and that and the other, and I'd like to know if you guys would. So we were looking for material because we were recording all the time. He brought a piece in that was all but impossible. We worked on this piece for the whole rehearsal. And after it was over, we still never did get it right. So Brownie finally looked at Oliver and laughed in his whimsical, funny way. He would laugh, and his whole body would say, he said, you know, I can write some music that you can't play either. But anyway, how you might get to that problem is write a piece for the group that you're with. Write a good piece, a good musical piece. And that would turn them around immediately. You just bring in some music, too. I know that most of the drummers that we see who really are out there today and have the kind of popularity that we see, you know, Tony Williams and all these guys, they do write. Kenny Clark, he's total percussionist. I heard a record recently that Kenny Clark made on vibraphone with Edgar Hayes in 1939. I said, wow, you know, I'm just saying that the guys who really have made some kind of contribution on this instrument have been total musicians. Yeah. So I know it's going to be difficult for you, but deal with those mallets. Yeah. Deal with that stuff, if you will. And also deal with some keyboard harmony. That might be a shortcut. An aid to it, you know. And don't, you know, hang with this, because that's what you like, and you'll get more out of that than anything else.
Yeah. It seems that, well, in recent years, to get any of your recordings, it's been, you've had to go to Italy or France, which is extremely unfortunate. It makes it a lot harder, but What I'm wondering is when you are dealing with a secular or a black city or solo and basic, what type of control do you have over release or any of that sort of material?
Well, I'll tell you.
Comparing to, let's say, an American record.
No, it's a big difference towards this year. In town, the horror record, I'll tell you about that. That was something that I just screamed about. He hit at me. The guy called me up. We haggled about money. Finally, he gave me what I wanted. So we were doing a concert in Torino that night. And we were hitting Torino, so we just flew to Rome during the day, early in the morning. Did the date, and I didn't stay there to edit or mix, and just left so we could make the concert. It's like, grab the money and run. Which is bad, because when I heard the album, I just shuddered. He had Cecil in the background. But it was representative of what it was. It was what we did and we deserved. I would never do that again. The most recent stuff I've done a duet with Anthony Braxton for Black Saint, and of course, Dollar Brand, and with Archie Shepp. And several quartet albums with Cecil, Billy Harper, and Reggie Workman. But the reason that I had stopped recording was when I went to around 1970, 71, we were all called in to our respective record companies and given albums, like, say, the Beatles, Sonny and Cher, and this and that. This is very serious. At least I was. And we were called in and we were asked. You know, like the way they approached me was, I knew the guys. I was signed with Atlantic, man. Nessie and then Marty Bender from 52nd Street, when Jerry Wexler, Nessie and Almond Erdogan used to carry records up four flights of stairs and storm in a little room. Now they're multi, it's like a Warner Brothers and all this stuff. Anyway, they called me and they said, Max, you know, you should be a rich man. Well, I can't agree with you first, but how do I go about it? How do I go about it? You know, this? They said, well, listen, take some of these records home and arrange this music the way that you want to and record that way. It's like riding on a hit tune. It's the beginning of a lot of things. You take a hit record and you arrange it, and they call it piggybacking or coattailing or whatever in the record business. Well, I took the things home. I didn't listen to any of it. And I said, well, and I read. And then I did the final album, which I did with the gospel jazz fusion thing. It was the last thing I did. And I took the job at the University of UMass and just laid out until my contract was over with Atlantic and just didn't do anything. Till now, I'm recording again, of course. But I noticed that reading Clive Davis's book, Clive, who was president of Columbia Records during that same period. During the same period, Miles was asked to come in and do the same. 70, 71, and all kind of coincided with Nixon being the president. The whole thing. It was very strange. We all were kind of caught up in kind of this way you use culture to choreograph the way people think and walk and talk, you know? And they say, okay, everybody dance. They call the musicians in and say, okay, from now on, it's dance music. Dance. We all, that's all we have, so we all dance. It's hard to think when you're dancing. So anyway, you know, when Miles was called in there, and of course he did those, his stuff I thought was fairly creative, you know. Bitches Brew and that, but he was leaning toward that, and it brought in a whole wave of all these great, great people who spent their lives really trying to be wonderful things, and they went into that area, because that was the way that the record companies had directed. I think things are easing up now, because of the fact that the musicians, the loft people, and all those folks who were doing the kind of music that was off the beaten path, Europeans and especially the people from Japan were coming over here and they were recording night and day and bringing it over to overseas and then distributed from points overseas and the stuff was selling. And so now the companies here are beginning to loosen up a little bit. Maybe the political scene is changing too, you see. But at that point, I like to think, and I'm not alone in that, that we were used to co-opt the youth into dealing with another thing, the artist was at that time. Because all of a sudden you got the Jaws syndrome and you got a whole lot of things just changed almost immediately, overnight. We were just inundated with garbage. Okay. And so, but my record, that's why I really stopped recording, because it was hard for me to really get into that. And so when people in Italy or Japan would come to me and say, anything you want to do is okay with us, then you can go in the studio and you have what we call artistic freedom. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to sell our records, though. But at least you have a chance to do what you want to do, you know, musically. And so you find there's some interesting things that are happening overseas that you don't hear here. When the guys go over there, they do make some interesting records.
Are you planning on trying to get any recordings together in the States?
I am, very hard. I'd like to, I really would like to do something at home. I really would. I really major label. Yeah, I really would.
I say, it took me almost a year to record the song.
I really would, yeah. Now I'm ready, and I think the companies are loosening up. When CBS signed Dexter, who was doing these things, it looked a little bit, there seemed to be some light at the end of the tunnel, and there wasn't another train coming. Bill Cosby joke. Yes.
Over the years since you played with Charlie Parker until now, your group sound has evolved tremendously. Do you find that you
that's hard to say, but I do have a running argument with critics. There's something like that scene in Waiting for Godot when the two men finally cussing each other out, and what ends the argument is when one calls the other a critic. But I know recently, I was criticized by one of my dean jazz critics, Mr. Leonard Feather. We came through L.A. and he does this too. And of course, Billy Harper and Cecil Bridgewater. And he says in his criticism, Max Roach, he's okay. Cecil Bridgewater is no Clifford Brown, and Billy Harper is no Sonny Rollins. So, you know, I never very seldom do this, but I call Leonard up the next day. We've been knowing each other for years. Incidentally, Leonard Feather wrote the first 5/4 piece that we recorded on an all-star metronome date way back from Metronome Magazine. This is probably you folks need to know. Metronome Magazine was a jazz magazine for downbeat. But they used to have all, they used to, the poll winners would get together and do a recording session for one of the major labels. And then the Feather, he's a musician, you know, that's what I'm saying. He read, so the first 5/4 thing he did was with Leonard. This was, all of us were on that thing. But anyway, so I called Leonard up, I said, Leonard, you know, this music allows us all the opportunity to be ourselves. You know, I wouldn't want Cecil to sound like Clifford Brown, or Billy Harper to sound like Sonny Rollins. You know, I encourage musicians the way I was encouraged. When Dizzy Gillespie heard me, he said, the reason I like you is because you don't sound like anybody else. Well, I didn't understand what he meant then, but later on when I started working with people like Lester Young and them, and they had ways of teaching you. Like you say, you had a nice night at the gig, and you might say to Les Young, good night, Prez. And he'd say to you, his good night would be a little lesson. He would say, you can't join the throng until you write your own song. And you know, that was, you know, you'd take that with you, you know, you could write volumes on a phrase like that. Which meant that you got to be yourself. And so I would call him up, he'd say, well, Max, you know, Billy Harper plays too long, and Cecil Bridgewater, and he's playing too many notes. I said, well, that's the way they feel about this thing. You know, there are people who are growing, and we encourage that. You know, this music, allows every generation to make a contribution. You know, like, because we had a Coleman Hawkins didn't mean that we can't have a tolerator Lester Young and later on a John Coltrane and so forth and so on. Because we had a Baby Dolls means that we can't tolerate a Bart Blakey or Elvin Jones or Tony Weir and go and just keep on going. It allows every generation to be some to participate in it. And that's our way, you know. It's not, you know, we don't stand on saying, okay, that's it and that's the end and there will be no more. It's not like that. It reflects the attitude and times in many, many ways.
Yeah,
well,
you mentioned your band, the Cecil Bridge runs really hard, and you mentioned Clifford Brown, Sam Ross. I was wondering if you could expound a bit on the band, Booker Didn't Have Love.
Okay. Well, first, yeah, you know, those were some. Booker, oh, yeah, okay. I first met Booker through Sonny Rollins when we went to Chicago. In fact, CBS had just put out an album more live at the Beehive, which had just come out, which was 150. Which is something I covered until people said, you know, maybe we should be out, and this is how Columbia got, because it was all that I had personally between Brownie and the memory of Brownie. And it was the tape that was all that was left of the car that that destroyed his life, Richie Powell, and Richie Powell's wife. But anyway, we were in Chicago, and it was around the same time that that album, that tape was done. But Harold Land, the original saxophone player, was had to go back to California. And we, and Sonny Rollins was in Chicago living at the YMCA. Brownie and I decided to go by to see him and ask him would he temporarily play with us until Harold straightened his business out at home and came back and come back to join us. And when we went over to the Y to see Sonny, he was downstairs practicing with a young trumpet player. Little. Sonny introduced Booker Little to Brownie and myself. But you know, you never think of things. He was great. He must have been about 17 or 18 then. Booker was. And he was this clean cut little kid working out with Sonny Rollins. But Sonny joined us, and of course, the rest is history. And during that period, of course, Brownie and I killed. Eric Dolphy, I first went to California and worked with the Lighthouse All Stars. Gene Norman, an entrepreneur out there, would come out to see us work, and he said, Max, why don't you start your own band? And this is when I went to New York after my contract was up with the Lighthouse All-Stars, and came back to New York and got Brownie and went back to California and formed that band. Well, in forming that band, we used to rehearse at Eric Dolphy's house in his father's garage. Eric never played with us. But he would always be the nicest person who gave us his garage and had a piano in, and we'd work out with him. And very seldom did I hear him play until he came to New York. And that's when he started, of course, that great relationship with John Coltrane, and he made some records with me and, in fact, worked on several things. But, you know, I think back now at how I met Booker Little and how I met Eric Dolphy. And they were so humble till I really didn't know that they were who they were when we first met, you know. And of course, those of you who may not know who these two young people were, they were some of the most significant musicians to come out of the States. Eric Dolphy, I guess you might say, was the first multi-reed instrumentalist who dealt with the music on various instruments before Anthony Braxton. On Anthony, for those of you who are familiar with the music, it's deals with so many reed instruments. And Booker Little, who died around the same age as Brownie died, I guess he was about 24, 25, from blood disease, was a very fine composer as well as a trumpeter. And he recorded with us, and recorded under his own name as well. He's not where he's right. Okay.
Do you have any questions?
I certainly do. I certainly will. I certainly will. Okay. Okay, now that gets me off. Well, one more question.
Yeah, could you just talk about the use of timpani? I think you use some on Bruin and Reverb. I just wanted to talk about that.
What I use is a timpani tom-tom, but I did record a piece called Dr. Freezy, for Al Freezy, whom I studied timpani with in Manhattan, who guy who taught us, Al Goodman, who was a great, he was with the New York Philharmonic, and he had a stroke, and then he went into teaching. I thought he was a great teacher, because when we'd be playing the repertoire in a small little studio, he was, and you had a passage that said FFF, and you know, you're in this little room, and you're playing your FFF just a little bit loud, he'd yell at you, hit the goddamn drum. So I wrote a piece, a jazz piece, it was a minor B-flat blues, it was a timpani melody, and then you call it the Mercury. And I also did another one on Timmy called Timminale from American Idol. And also with Thelonious Monk, I used Timmy on Adventure Swing. On the thing with Anthony Braxton, Birth and Rebirth, I used that Italian tunable tom-tom. That's what you hear. Yes, an Italian tunable tom-tom. They make it exclusively there, but now Japanese have picked it up and they're manufacturing it. No, that's true. Yeah, I just write the thematic material down for publishing purposes. And then just, revolve around it. It's mostly like, you establish a thing and you go away from another, and then you set up something like the mountain on Big City.
Is it different with the one you play that's used in the Democratic Republic, the piece for South Africa?
Yeah.
Is it a different set than that?
Yeah, well, that piece is kind of like, you establish a thing like it's a clothesline and you hang little things on it. Performing that piece.
How do you like the modern one going around to say like just 20 minutes, Steve Gadd?
Listen, Steve Gadd is making so much money playing in the studio. You can't knock that one. Of course, Tony, I think, is a genius. I really do. I think Tony is really exceptional, very creative. You know? I met Tony when he was about 13 or 14. We worked at a place in Boston called the Hi-Hat, and his dad, who was a saxophone player, brought him to see us. Clifford Brown, and we were all together with the band then, and he came and sat in with us and played all my solos off the record. So later, what I did when he got to be about 16, I invited him to spend the summer with me in my house so I could get something from him. But he's really brilliant. He's something very special, I believe. And Cobbler is another one, that's technically unbelievable. Of course, music, there are a lot of subtleties that go along with life, too, And, they have all the equipment to work with now, so you can imagine what it's going to be like as they, they say you haven't really learned to live until you've loved and lost. And so, I can imagine as they grow older and become more experienced, a lot of things will come to them, and all that technique will be distilled into something even more than what they're doing today. I had a request to do something on brushes. Yeah. And then later on, of course, when I hit 52nd Street and the old timers, these men would tell me how to do these things. We changed, and I would play a piece maybe with that. And actually, we lifted the brush off the drum. Thank you. heart and use the presence to me. And of course, they always work in all kinds of situations. You use them, of course, today on all the instruments and on all the and all the drums that you see up here. And just for reference, one of the finest brush players out here today that I know of is Philadelphia Joe Jones. Yeah, and he's written, he's also did some writing on it, and he has a book on it, just brush work. And so if you really want to get into brushes, he's got a book, and I think he's also done some very exciting work on records and brushes as well. I'm going to continue, you know.
You talked about your story about the records you did for the Max.
Yes.
You also talked a bit about playing with different people through time.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about this record because it fascinates me. It seemed to be a totally different context for you at once, whether there were specific problems that you had to deal with playing with someone like the Max.
Well, when we had made the deal finally with the record company Black Saint in Atlanta to do the recording, he was in the States and I was in Europe. In fact, I was at the Willowside Festival in Switzerland. And I flew to Milano and I guess they flew Anthony in from the States to Milano, and that was the first time I had seen Anthony Gatsby. And the night before I flew into Milano, I stopped by the producer of the festival house and listened to some Anthony Braxton records, which is my fault. Because I had not had an opportunity to hear Anthony or something, but I had heard a lot about it. And while we were negotiating the deal, it took about a year before they really put it together for us to do this album. Once in a while at a festival in Europe, I'd see Anthony, and we kind of waved to each other because we knew they were negotiating. But anyway, when we got to Milano, I got there, he was already at the hotel, and he was in the lobby. Anthony wears glasses like I do. Very bright, precise, young man. And he's in the lobby with a note, with a music pad and a pencil. And as I come in the lobby, rolling my luggage, the producer, he's waiting. He says, and we're introduced, he says, "Hello, Mr. Roach." He says, "What are we going to do tomorrow?" He's I say, to show you how Anthony is, you know, he's right on it. And so I said, well, first I'm going to check at the hotel. And I said, why don't you and I get rid of the producers and everything and go someplace and have dinner? Which is what we did, and we had dinner and we talked about everything we used. And we both retired for the night, got up the next morning, we built the studio at 10 o'clock, went to the studio, and we just hit. We just said, play. And we played for about 2 hours straight, changing instruments, everything, getting our attitudes and ideas from each other. And out of that 2 hours, we curled 40 minutes. We edited 40 minutes out of it that made sense to us. But even the stuff where we were doodling, looking for ideas, sounded good. So then we have all that saved anyway. That's how that album was made. It was pure improvisation. And it worked out well because he's a fine musician. And historically, he was well aware of what I was about. And technically, you know, if you've got it all here, and you have the kind of attitude Anthony has, you know, he's one of the easiest persons I've had to work with.
Did you see any types of things in his conception that were different to you that you hadn't seen before or you were surprised at?
Yeah, quite frankly, yes. Yeah. You know, his approach to things is kind of sometimes ethereal and airy and requires another kind of feeling from, at least from me. And I think he brought out some things in me that I had never experienced before music. And I hope I did the same for him.
How could you adapt the way you wanted to sound?
To Anthony?
Yeah.
I don't know. It kind of worked out. Just You know, if I introduced an attitude, he just went right into it. And if he introduced an attitude, I would do my best to get involved in it just like that. If it was free with his the way he does things. Well, it requires, like, you have to just use the imagination and have perhaps command the instrument. It makes it work together. It's funny. And when we did the date, the critics of Italy, because we were in Milan, they had the same thing, wondering, how is this going to work out? That's good from this period, and that from here. What is this, you know? So what we did, we didn't allow anybody in the studio but the producer and just him and I. Well, after we did the record, 2 days later, we did an open concert in Nerdy. It's a beautiful festival place. It's on the Mediterranean coast. And before the concert, we had a press conference, and all the critics were there. Nobody was witness to what was going on. So they said, how did you find, Anthony, what, you know? And we tried to say that it worked for us, I guess, because we both tried to make it work for us. You know, I know he had to give some, and I had to give some. We both tried to satisfy whatever it was that he was trying to do, and I'm sure he did for me, because we did one piece that was like this, the way I did things. And he was right. Have you got the record? He was on the case. Then we just kind of slipped in and out of ideas and attitudes. The only thing that we did discuss about the date was that we were going to be intense and soft and long as possible, and and he likes to deal with colors. He said maybe we'll be red here, maybe we'll be blue here. And things like that, you know. So that's what we did. Finally, talk with you, just to understand one another. But I enjoyed that session. It's one of my favorite efforts.
Do you see newer people that you'd like to work with? Maybe that.
Well, listen. Since I did the album with Anthony, I've had a lot of offers to do some stuff with Hammond and do it and all of them. They come up and give me albums and say, "Listen, man." It's a great compliment because they are some great players, some great young players. And it's a great compliment. All right, go back to Kirk. Thank you. Thank you. Just aside, you know, I learned, you learn so many things from so many different people. And I remember when I was growing up in New York City and Charlie Parker first came to New York. And I had, as a young kid who had worked with Duke Ellington when he was 16 and at the New York Paramount, and things like that. And so I became a little cocky. So when Charlie Parker came to New York in Kansas City, of course, he was, and with Dizzy Gillespie and all of us, we were working on 52nd Street. And I remember I came to rehearsal late on the street one day, and they were all sitting down waiting for me. Charlie Parker had a lesson in store. When I walked in, he was sitting at the drums, and with that impish smile of his, he said, he asked me, could I do something? He was sitting and he played something for me and asked me if I could do it. Now, for those of you who are drummers, you'll understand what this is. He asked me, could I play 4-4 with my bass drum, Charleston beat with my hi-hat, foot cymbal, shuffle rhythm with my left hand, and the standard chick-chain jazz beat with my right hand. I said, I don't know. He said, let me show you how to do it, and he played it with a saxophone across his lap. Well, I tried it, and he reduced me to nothing. And so I went home and worked on it. And it's always a challenge. And I want you guys, just for the fun of it, to work it out sometimes at home. But it was the first time that I guess I had really been introduced to what we call separation, you know, the four limbs doing different things. Piece that was really introduced to me by that great drummer, Mr. Jonathan Samuel David Jones. He was the original Count Basie drummer. He's still with us today. And he was a master of the foot cymbal. And I'm going to play a piece that I wrote using his techniques. And the title of it is a dedication to him. It's called Mr. Papa Joe. And we're going to close the set with this one. Thank you. piece from an old Atlantic recording. The album was entitled Drums Unlimited, and the title of that piece was The Drum Also Waltzes. I'm going to continue with another piece from the same album, and the theme of this piece is taken from a Louis Armstrong recording entitled Mop Mop. And for the sake of publishing, I changed the title. And I call it the Big Sidney Catlett, a gentleman who was a great inspiration to me. Probably was one of the finest drummers who ever lived. He played not only with Louis Armstrong, but he also played and recorded rather with Louis Armstrong, but he also performed and recorded with Benny Goodman and his orchestra after Cooper had left the band. So here's the Big Sidney. During the 60s, rather toward the end of the 60s, No, during the 50s, this was, toward the end of the 50s, quite a few of the musicians in the States here were experimenting with what we call odd meters. Odd meters are those meters that are not even meters. In any case, an odd meter would be 3-4, 5-4, 7-4, 9-4. And in 1958, when I had with me on my band at that time Stanley Turrentine and Tommy Turrentine and Bobby Boswell and Julian Priester, very fine trombonists, and of course we all know the great heights that Stanley Turrentine has come to musically and commercially. And once in a while he visits me with his Mercedes 450 STL. In any case, we had been experimenting with meters, and we recorded during that same year after a trip to Europe a piece in 5-4, which we called As Long As You're Living, and it was in an album called Quiet As It's Kept. You know, I named that album that because it was kept quiet. In any case, during the same time, we played a festival with the same group in Detroit. And we introduced the 5-4 piece, and I remember a very fine group also from the West Coast came backstage after we finished our performance, and they were excited because they said they had been experimenting with these odd meters as well. That group, of course, was the great Dave Brubeck Quartet. And I remember 2 years later, about 1960, they came out with their very famous and popular Take 5, and we often wondered if they took the 5 from us. In any case, this particular piece is in 7-4. It's in 7-4, and the title of it is just Jasme, which is spelled J-A-S-M-E.
Thank you.
again to tell you how great it makes me feel to know that so many of you out there appreciate deep harmonies and sonorous melodies. The next piece, the title album from that first Atlantic, partially solo album I did, Drums Unlimited is the title of now, DVD, Drums Unlimited piece, which Drums Unlimited. Of this first portion of our program, catch my breath. And this is a piece that recently I recorded in duet with one of the great musicians, our day, Mr. Archie Shepp. And it won the Grand Prix International to Disc for Best Modern Jazz Recording in France in 1977. It's from the album entitled Force, and the album actually was inspired. Mr. Shepp and I both were in Europe on a tour with our groups when Chairman Mao died. And so as we were both winding up our tour, we were asked by the young Italian Communist Party if we would do a concert in Rome for Unitas, is what they call themselves there, for the Unitas Festival, and also to commemorate and celebrate Chairman Mao in life as well as death. So he and I got together and we put a double album set out, which eventually became a double album set, and we did, well anyway, we prepared the work for the concert in Rome, and the some members of the French Socialist Party were at the performance, and they asked us to come up to Paris after we finished the performance to record it. So we recorded it, and that's how we won the Grand Prix International du Disc. I'm going to now play a drum solo from one of the cuts in that album, because during 1976, when Mao died, there was also a lot of activity in South Africa, where so many people were being killed, maimed, and so forth and so on, at the Soweto situation. So we dedicated one of the cuts to that situation. We called it South Africa '76.